disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you find our show interesting and you'd like to support us, please consider heading over to patreon.com/deadsouls and donating to our research and investigations. If Instagram is more your thing, you can find us there by searching Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us. This is Time's Up, part two of our Armageddon double feature. The event that is causing the end of the world right now. At the end of the last episode, we left you on a precipice. The end of mankind as we know it has already begun, we proclaimed. But it's true, we are in the end times. I'm not a seer, a fortune teller, prophet, or sideshow hustler who claims to know it all. But I do know about this. The Red Hat fraternity will say, he's gone woke, he's talking about climate change. Well, I'm not. You'd also be forgiven if you thought that I was talking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I mean, yes, that could escalate further and bring about nuclear annihilation. But that's impossible to predict with any accuracy. No, I'm talking about something a lot more certain. Something evidenced, with supporting data, and which many experts can and do agree on. The truth is, the end of mankind has been in motion since December 1991. Can it be averted? Probably not anymore. It's too late. Do the governments of the world know it's happening? Some do, absolutely. Others, lesser so. So let's get into it. Chapter 1. Conspiracy. I am, and have always been, a firm believer in reading books. Reading books that are written by qualified and experienced experts in their respective fields, as both a source of factual information and also for entertainment. Literature. Since the consumer-related emergence of the internet in the mid-1990s, but particularly over the last 10 years, we have seen the rise of the shallow thinker. Someone of low to average intelligence with poor cognitive skills and subpar attention spans. I aim not to mock, however. These individuals, usually male by statistical evidentiary data, try to portray themselves as intelligent, free thinkers. Hell, they may even seem intelligent to those who are lesser so. They often use phrases like, do your own research, or don't believe the official narrative. These individuals are the new wave of conspiracy theorists. You see, the internet has given everyone, particularly in Western culture, information quite literally in the palm of their hands and at the ease of a click of a button. The promise the World Wide Web gave us in the 1990s was a bold one, a future of limitless potential and knowledge. It gave birth to the information age, the age we are currently festering in. Festering because the future didn't quite evolve how we thought it would, how we hoped, how it could have been. Information and data is now weaponized by governments against governments and against their own people, by political rivals against each other, in marketing and advertisement to perpetuate agendas of which there are millions, to broadcast propaganda and counter-propaganda and covert subliminal propaganda. Corporations, big pharma, tech giants, institutions, media, agencies, services, and religions. How do you know who to trust? Who to trust? And what is actually real? Are you? Yes, you, the person listening to this right now. Are you able to identify a credible source? Are you able to source legitimate research with probable data to support outcomes and a hypothesis? In an age of instant information, it's perhaps now more than ever the most difficult it has ever been to obtain facts and true information. You have to put in the work to get to the truth. You see, we take for granted in a globalist society having almost anything instantaneously and how we want it, at least in the Western first world. But has that same globalism also meant quality of information is even more difficult to come by? Watered down and polluted, maybe. The average citizen might complain about not trusting the media, yet they will consume it in vast amounts daily. Self-aware of how problematic that situation is, yet unable to resolve it, thus creating a society of distrust, political disarray, and a growth in conspiracy theorists. So, how is any of this contributing to the end of the civilization? Well, directly it doesn't. It does, however, water down its resistance. Chapter 2. Globalization. Now, this chapter can get incredibly detailed and intricate, but I'm going to keep it brief, streamlined, and just bare facts and data to make it as digestible as possible to the average listener. Trust me, unless you are deeply entrenched in mathematics, international financial history, geopolitics, or global marketing 101, this section could be a challenge to get through. So, in an attempt to make it as palatable as possible, here we go. In 1943, as the Second World War progressed, the Allied forces came to realize that victory began to look ever more certain. The United States and the United Kingdom organized a conference in New Hampshire. It was called the Bretton Woods Conference, also known at the time as the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference. It was the gathering of some 730 delegates from all 44 Allied nations at the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, United States. The purpose of the conference was to regulate the international monetary and financial order after the conclusion of the Second World War. The conference ran from July the 1st to July the 22nd, 1944. During which agreements were signed that, following formal legislative ratification by member states and nations, would establish the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the IBRD, which would later become part of the World Bank Group, and also would form the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. This led to what was commonly called the Bretton Woods System for International Commercial and Financial Relations. This system of monetary management established the rules for commercial and financial relations among the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, European countries, Australia, and Japan. The Bretton Woods system was the first example of a fully negotiated monetary order intended to govern monetary relations among independent states. Its regulations and the system remains in force to this very day. The result of the collective economists and delegates at the time resulted in representatives from all the leading Allied nations favouring a regulated system of fixed exchange rates, indirectly disciplined by a United States dollar that was tied to the gold standard, a system that in turn relied on a regulated market economy under tight controls regarding the values of currencies. Such a system was the brainchild of John Maynard Keynes, a British economist and philosopher whose ideas fundamentally changed the theory and practice of macroeconomics and the economic policies of governments throughout the 20th century. In fact, apart from a brief decline of popularity from the 1990s to 2007, Keynes' policies are still very much the bedrock of Western government policy to this day. The Bretton Woods system led directly to the expansion of globalization and interdependence of the world's economies, cultures, and populations, brought about by cross-border trade in goods and services, technology, and flows of investment, people, and information. Once the Cold War ended in 1990, globalization exploded and became the standard throughout the entire developed world. Globalization allows everyone to have reach of anything, at any item or service. Any standard of product, standard of living, and outcome they desire. It brought the so-called American dream to every nation on earth. Global supply chains or production networks that assemble products using parts from around the world, known as intermediate goods, is now the standard. Today, 80% of world trade is driven by supply chains run by multinational corporations.
trade in intermediate goods is now nearly twice as large as trade in final goods, and is especially important in advanced manufacturing like automobiles, robotics, artificial intelligence, composite materials, and network integration. This means it is cheaper to assemble parts and ship than to create whole items and sell. Globalization was intended to be, and effectively still is, a tool for prosperity for all and for global peace. The idea was to create a better world with countries seeking to cooperate with one another to promote a one-world system. Free trade and the rule of law were mainstays of the system. It helped to prevent most economic disputes from escalating into larger conflicts, which was standard in pre-war imperialism and trade conflicts of the centuries that preceded industrialization. The United States had the opportunity following the end of the Second World War to become the global leader, the global leader. It could have effectively developed its own American empire in the ruins of a war that had decimated most nations on the planet. It chose not to, however. It chose to make the world equal and stronger together in the hope of instilling peace and equality. With the economic minds and organization of the British, the two allies put into force their globalization theory. It has meant that every Western generation born since the 1950s has had the opportunity to have a stable, peaceful, safe and prosperous life, equal in opportunity to any other person of any other nation who enrolled in the program. By 1990, this was literally everyone. Your comfortable existence is due in part, no, in full, to this world structure. The Bretton Woods system and subsequently globalization also directly led to the creation of the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Globalization encourages each participating nation to specialize in what it produces best, using the least amount of resources. This is known as comparative advantage. This concept makes production more efficient, promotes economic growth, and lowers the prices of goods and services, making them more affordable, especially for lower-income households. Pretty cool, right? Without this, the price of products in your local store would be significantly higher. This is because bulk production and marketing drives the cost down to a bare base minimum, which is passed to the consumer, with volume still generating huge profits for the manufacturer. In turn, longer markets enable companies to reach more customers and get a higher return on the fixed costs of doing business, like building factories or conducting research. Technology companies have taken special advantage of their innovations this way in particular. Competition from abroad and foreign markets drive firms to improve their products. The consumers have better products and more choices as a result. Think Apple and Samsung, for example, who are regularly able to release upgraded and more advanced models of their products. This drives development and technological progression. Additionally, expanded trade spurs the spread of technology, innovation, and the communication of ideas. The best ideas from market leaders spread more easily. Globalization supports new job opportunities, but also contributes to job displacement. It has not significantly changed the total number of positions in the economy, as job numbers are primarily driven by business cycles and fiscal policies. Nevertheless, a Peterson Institute study finds that 156,250 U.S. manufacturing jobs were lost on net each year between 2001 and 2016. This is from expanded trade in manufactured goods. This represents less than 1% of the workers laid off in a typical year, however. Low-wage workers in certain regions are most affected. Many of them also face lower earnings or have dropped out of the workforce altogether. Bigger factors than trade that drive job displacements are labor-saving technologies like automated machines and artificial intelligence. Better-paying positions have opened up in manufactured exports, especially in high-tech areas such as computers, chemicals, and transportations. And other skilled work, notably in business services such as finance and real estate. Globalization has also helped narrow inequality on a vast scale between the poorest and richest people in the world. In fact, the number living in extreme poverty has been cut by half since 1990 alone. Does globalization displace jobs? Of course it does. Competition, costs, and skill set locations all play a part in the workforce moving around and evolving. But economists look at the effects of globalization across the entire economy to weigh up the pros and cons. Since the overall payoff is so much greater than the cost of individual workers or groups who have lost out, nearly all economists support having an open global market versus closing it off or becoming nation-specific focused. You will almost certainly have heard all the world leaders talk of global cooperation, support, and underpinning the same end goals. It's not a secret society, the Illuminati, or a conspiracy of the powerful elite. It's the agreed and fundamental basis of all governments for the benefit of all their citizens. It's globalization. Now, those of you with right-leaning views might be saying to yourselves that this is pure globalist propaganda. Well, it's not. I'm not flag-waving for any party, organization, or ideology. I'm just communicating facts that are freely available for you all to see and read. Let's look at the United States, for example. Since 1950, globalization policies have led to the increase of the United States economy to $2.1 trillion annually. That equates to $7,000 per person, or $18,000 per household in the continental United States. There is no negative to this global approach from the perspective of the US government, only gains. This is an opinion shared by all the G20 nations, even our enemies. This option is shared by the US, the UK, France, Germany, Russia, China, Australia, New Zealand, Spain, Italy, Canada, and I could go on and on and on and on. To talk simplistically, globalization allows you to have strawberries at any time in the year, in any country, cheap groceries, unlimited and the latest technological consumer electronics, minimal work hours to recreation time balance, annual holidays, world travel, affordable clothing, cheap fuel for your home and car, the ownership of a car at all, access to medicines, and most importantly, the opportunity to go anywhere and do anything whilst having cheap access to any product you require at any time. It really is hard to imagine that prior to the Bretton Woods system being incorporated, something as simple as an apple, which would cost a few pence or cents now, would have cost around $67 in parts of the country where it wasn't grown. And outside the country of growth, forget about it. You would not be able to attain this item at all. At the time of this expense, the average wage in the United States was around 45 cents per hour, or around £1.40 per week in the United Kingdom. Imagine saving all your money for a year to be able to eat an apple, when people who lived near an orchard might eat them daily for free. There was simply no balance. The system was crazy, unbalanced, and the only real attainments were what your local village could provide. You will either love or loathe globalization. Some see it for the standard of living it provides us now. Others see it as a system of control and a look to a simpler way of living that history makes alluring to those with views of simplicity. Often people will accuse governments of inaction or not caring about specific people or situations, not considering that the government is viewing the situation from a perspective of globalization protectionism, that the greater is more important than the sum. The Bretton Woods system has always been dependent on one thing, however: protection. As part of the Bretton Woods system, the United States and British military would guarantee the security of all members in general, while the United States and UK navies specifically would guard all trade amongst all participants. No longer will the world powers have a need for independent military forces, and all would have a vested interest in collaboration with the Allied superpowers. The policy ushered in the greatest era of peace and prosperity that humanity had ever known, and was the leading factor in the containment and ultimate defeat of the Soviet Empire. Chapter 3. Today and the next day. Now, I'm going to talk about the future, world building, and how things will play out. This isn't guesswork on my part, so you shouldn't take it as my speculation. Rather, I'll be referring to the work of US geopolitical strategist Peter Zeihan, Peterson Institute for International Economics, and Harvard-educated globalization and political economist Danny Roderick. These three sources of data, analysis, and evidential information are trusted by governments, corporations, and leaders the world over. They have only produced impeccable results historically, and trillion-dollar economies rest on their advice and predictions. So, let's talk the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Firstly, it's not a special military operation like the Russians are trying to frame it. It's not a mission of denazification of Ukraine. Hell, if one side behaved in a fascist and Nazi-like way, it's certainly not Ukraine. Hell, if one side behaved in a fascist and Nazi-like way, it certainly isn't Ukraine. And further, it's not a crusade to rid Ukraine of gay demons either, like Russian media are now saying. This is entirely true, by the way. The invasion of Ukrainian sovereign territory is nothing more than a good old-fashioned land grab on the Russians' part. Unfortunately, this is just something that was always going to happen, and it's not just going to stop at Ukraine. Strategists know this. The country of Russia and the space they occupy is among the worst non-arable farmland in the world. The Russians have never been able to generate enough income to have a complete road network. The country is decades behind the rest of the world in that respect. Everything still has to be moved by rail. In addition to this, their frontiers are huge and open. Vast, unprotected and unguarded space that would be almost impossible to police given the size of the country and lack of transport infrastructure. So if you've got a military force that can't maneuver itself, and your only reasonable defense strategy is to be forward positioned and use geography to help you out and aid your defense. So naturally, as a military strategist, you would expand until you reach mountains or oceans or deserts. And then you anchor on either side of those and plug up the access points. Unfortunately for Ukraine, there are two of those access points on either side of the country. So the Russians were always, always going to try to push through and retake the territory that they had controlled on and off for most of the last 350 years. Ukraine, however, have developed their nation and national identity since they split from the Soviet Union in 1990, and were not simply about to allow Russia to walk across them. Russia had acted too late. Ukraine were already in bed with NATO and the European Union, strong friends to have and to allow you the balls to say no to Russia. One of the common descriptors that Russia pushed regarding the start of the war was that the Ukrainians were welcoming in NATO, and thus NATO was moving their weaponry closer to the border of Russia. Whilst there is arguably something to be said for that, remember that Russia already has Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania at their border, who are all NATO members, plus Norway at their most northerly point. You'll have to put it into context to really understand it. The Russian point of view is to be secure. They need to expand until they reach a point where invaders cannot overwhelm them. They have to be able to seal those access points. If the West was to give the Russians what they want, they would have to sign over the future of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Finland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Slovakia, Romania, Belarus, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, and Kazakhstan. And that's just not feasible under the current world order. So the individuals who claim that NATO provoked this war are not correct at all. For Russia to feel safe and secure, they would need to occupy over 180 million people, a return to the days of the Soviet Union. And that will never ever happen, particularly given Russia's weakened military power, weakened compared to what it was as part of the Soviet Union. Whilst Ukraine essentially rolled over regarding Crimea in 2014, this was not the situation any longer. Ukraine were prepared following 7 years of separatist fighting in the eastern Donbas region. The Russians, however, underestimated them. They thought it would be a simple task, as it was in 2014. They couldn't have been further from reality. The Ukrainians surprised Russia, but most importantly, the Europeans surprised Russia. Unlike the last 7 times that the Russians have gone on the warpath since 1999, the Europeans have stood up and said enough is enough. That has fundamentally changed the game and caught Putin significantly off guard. Behind the scenes, the NATO superpowers are preparing for one of two scenarios to play out in this war. Ukrainians being the underdog here, but are in the process of rapidly arming with more and more sophisticated equipment thanks to their Western supporters. And by the time we get to May, they will have been able to have completed significant maintenance on the equipment that they have captured from the Russians thus far in the war. This equipment alone is more equipment than the Ukrainians started the war with. Additionally, there will be 60,000 Ukrainian troops that have trained in NATO countries with even more advanced equipment back in the field. On the opposing side, the Russians will finish their second mobilization, and they will have at least another 500,000 men in the field. They will be badly trained and badly equipped and badly led with low morale. This has already been established. But there's nothing about this war that is unique in Russian history. For them, the first year is always an absolute shit show. Always. And then the Russians do what they do best and throw bodies at the problem until it goes away. Manpower, significant amounts of it, and that has always been a Russian strength. Historically, in half of those wars, the Russians ultimately win. So by the time we get to May, I say May as that's when the mud season is over, we'll have a more advanced Ukrainian force fighting a much larger Russian force. We will get our first real glimpse of how this war is likely to go. In theory, the war will still take time after this, because if the Russians are going to win, it's going to take them a year or so to overwhelm Ukrainian defences, and then they have to occupy the country, which will result in the deaths of a few million people. The alternative is that Russian supply chains fail, or get destroyed by the Ukrainians, resulting in well over 500,000 dead Russian soldiers. The Ukrainians will be able to push the Russians out of Crimea in the east, which will allow the second phase of the war. Because this is just the opening phase of what it's going to be a multi-year war, and perhaps even multi-decade conflict, when that happens, all bets are off, as the Russian bear will be backed into a corner and humiliated globally, and its options will significantly narrow. It's easy to guess what may happen here if Putin is still alive. But would Russia resort to the nuclear option? Highly experienced analysts advising NATO nations, including the United States and UK, state that Russia would have to be very, very desperate to press the nuclear button. Zeihan recently stated in an interview that there are likely to be only a small few scenarios that the Russians are looking at regarding the nuclear option right now. Scenario 1. The Russians launching a warhead against the United States, their major competitor. This is highly unlikely, not just because of mutual assured destruction, but because the United States intelligence has also subtly let it be known to the Russians that they know exactly where Putin is every minute of every single day. The KGB days are over, and Russia has been an open door for over two decades. British and American intelligence services are able to intercept every level of government communications right up to Putin himself. Putin is said to be aware that the Allies listen to his phone calls, read his emails, and have people inside the Kremlin. Does this lead to an extremely paranoid Putin? Of course it does, but Russia is just simply not able to combat it. Putin knows very clearly that if he instigates a nuclear attack against the United States, that they will likely end the existence of Russia as a nation, and Putin personally, with a warhead especially for him, such as the official written defense plan scenario. The NATO countries know that Putin's nuclear rhetoric and tough talk in the media is just that, talk. This is why NATO member states never ever respond. Scenario 2. The Russians nuke in Ukraine. This scenario would make next to no sense. The Russians want to occupy Ukraine. They don't want it to be a radioactive nuclear wasteland. That would make the entire point of the conflict moot. There were senior Russian conversations at the start of the war which was intercepted by British intelligence. They revealed that the Russians considered, or at least discussed, launching a nuclear attack against Poland, Berlin, and Stockholm in order to disrupt their weapon flows into Ukraine. It's now too late to see any outcome of use of this scenario, given the amount of weaponry Ukraine now have, be that seized Russian weapons or arms from the West. The only legitimate scenario where the Russians would seriously consider using nuclear weapons is if Ukraine doesn't simply win, but decides to carry the fight across the border into Russia. Until now, they haven't been able to do that. But with the West now supplying missiles, weapons, tanks, and soon fighter jets, this is a possible scenario. Where the very existence of the Russian government is threatened, that would probably change the mathematics of the situation. Washington, London, and Berlin are providing the Ukrainians with the weaponry, yes, but they're also providing them with intelligence, military training, and expertise, and most of the steps of the kill chain. The Ukrainians know that the West don't want the war to enter Russia, and the Ukrainians have no desire to rupture their relationship with NATO, so the likelihood is that they will show border restraint, at least at this juncture. Let's hope, though, that Russia doesn't commit any more significant war crimes that enrage Ukraine to a point of total war. Proponents against the support of Ukraine and against their funding and them having military resources do so with an isolationist agenda. There's a lot of that in Western countries right now. Why should our tax money fund their war? Is a common question. The simple answer is this. If Russia isn't stopped and the war will be taken to the NATO countries, either conventionally or by nuclear exchange, Ukraine are fighting so the West doesn't have to. The alternative is Ukraine falls and NATO troops will have to fight directly, which comes with significantly more cost, both financially and in lives, not to mention facing war at home. So, is this the end? Is this the scenario that's already in play that will lead to the end of mankind as we know it? Well, no. It's a possible wildcard on the horizon, sure, but it's not the certainty that most governments with strong advisors will already be aware of. Chapter 4. In our lifetime. I'll cut to the chase. The scenario that will change everything and cost millions of lives and change mankind forever during our lifetime is this. The fall of globalization. It has already begun. It's more than a decade in the making. One of the main factors in globalization and the continued expansion is demographics. Population and workforce numbers are set to fall globally with the exception of the United States, United Kingdom and Canada. As we've been talking about Russia a lot, let's use them in this example. The Russian demographic position is that it is in permanent diseased, aged and terminal decline. So much so that projections by the Peterson Institute and also economic advisors to the US, UK and European Union state that the Russian state will come to an end sometime between 2045 and 2070. The facts behind this is that Russia has had a series of big scoops removed from their birth rate throughout the 20th century. World War I, then World War II. The collectivization under Stalin, plus Brezhnev's mismanagement, followed by Khrushchev's mismanagement, and the post-Cold War collapse. This means that there are more Russians in their 50s, in their 40s, and their 30s, which means that there aren't enough Russians that have been born in the last 30 years to carry the ethnicity forward much farther. But that also means that carrying the country forward economically too. The hard truth is certainly a factor in the Ukraine situation. The Russians know as a nation that they will become weaker, so by taking defensive lands and huge population swathes is a small step to slowing this process. None of this is new information to world powers, Russia included. 2022 is the last year where Russia will have enough men in their 20s to be able to execute a military invasion before they age out. Is that a coincidence, do you think? Russia has always been poorly managed and completely authoritarian, but under Putin, it's taken a much darker turn, due in part to the nature of the Cold War ending. You see, back in 1982, there was a coup in the Soviet Union. KGB agents basically overthrew the old system of Brezhnev and took over. They were the only ones who really had a full understanding of what was going on to control the information. They were unable to save the system, and thus it broke. Well, Putin is the successor to that legacy. He was KGB. And now we're in an environment with that terminal demographic structure of the Soviet system and Putin's personal paranoia thrown in the mix. He has, over time, gone through and purged what was left of the old KGB. We are now left with an entire political elite in Russia of just 130 people, and Putin has removed anyone who has leadership ambitions or abilities. All 130 of Putin's inner circle all see the world the same way. They all agree with Putin on what's at stake here, but it does mean that when this generation is gone, that is it. This is all the leadership talent that the country has. And even if Russia did have a replacement generation coming up, which it doesn't, Putin has taken steps to make sure that they are unable to challenge him, and so any sort of leadership talent has been eliminated. What's left is a massively reduced population in complete disarray due to a political and economic vacuum. To be clear, however, Russia is simply a symptom and not a cause. So if you recall from earlier, if we go back a little bit in history, before World War II, any nation that had coal, oil, food and iron could pretty much industrialize and try to make something of themselves, right? But if you failed to have even one of these resources, you were probably a colony of a larger nation or empire. Then the Bretton Woods system came about, globalization, and most nations industrialized. Then, with the end of the Cold War, the developing world played catch-up, and they also industrialized. The problem is that this is all temporary, because birth rate keeps dropping, people keep living older, and your societal structure inverts. Now you no longer have children, you no longer have a replacement generation at all, and there aren't enough people in their 20s and 30s to buy everything which pumps the economy, and there aren't enough people in their 40s and 50s to pay for the retirees in the form of investments which stimulate the economy. So this decade was always going to be the decade that most of the advanced world moves into mass retirement and the economic model collapses. And next decade was always going to be the decade that the same happened to the developing world. No prophecies, no conspiracies, just simple mathematics and economics. Recent studies have also found out that China, although late to the industrialization game, played it so fast that they caught up with the West, and now this is their last decade too. So all of the globalized connections and consumptions that create the world that balance the global market and model are at the end of the road. We will be forced to go back to a world where trade is more focused on the countries that have a better demographic and security infrastructure, not too dissimilar from the old imperial model. We are losing the security ramifications of an open system. At the same time, we're losing the demographic capacity to support it in the first place, and that's all happening right now. So yeah, I mentioned China. Well, without young people, we have seen the Chinese labor costs increase by a factor of 14 since the year 2000. Mexican labor, by comparison, is now one-third the cost of Chinese labor. The Chinese educational system focuses solely on memorization over skills. So despite $1 trillion of investment in a bottomless supply of intellectual property theft, the Chinese really haven't advanced technologically in the last 15 years. Mexican labor is probably about twice as skilled as Chinese labor is now, even though it's one-third of the cost, and they haven't consolidated into an ethnic-based paranoid nationalistic cult of personality to boot. In addition, it's very difficult for the Xi administration to even run because it's not an administration anymore. It's now an autocracy, much like Russia. No one wants to bring Xi information regarding anything the US intelligence gathering has highlighted. This makes for a state with their head in the sand. Fun fact here, the Biden administration is currently taking the trade policy of Donald Trump and implementing it in state institutions. So we now have growing barricades preventing the Chinese from buying the equipment, the tools, or the software that's necessary to make semiconductors. So the Chinese tech system has already stalled. They don't have the young people to go consumption-led. Thus, China are the most economically vulnerable country in the world right now. The Chinese are the world's largest importer of both food and energy. Without the globalization model, the Chinese will face huge food shortages and famine. Additionally, without the power they need, the manufacturing sector will collapse, and likely with it the economy, and shortly following it, the government. This will happen this decade. China is currently torn over Taiwan too. NATO is watching this very closely. Whilst China want to absorb Taiwan into its country, and with it the powerful economy and manufacturing sector, they are also aware that sanctions placed on their country could have catastrophic impact given their import-to-export ratio. Stop China's imports and the government will almost certainly collapse. The government of Xi Jinping is more than aware of this. China is very precariously balanced above a precipice, and it needs global partners not to survive, but to prolong their current existence. This is the reason China is opening up to Russia and South American nations. What will the world look like in 10 years? Well, a system of regional trade, where you've got certain regional powers who control localized blocks. Something like the following will play out. The United Kingdom will join with the Scandinavian countries as their history is rich of cooperation and shared values. The United Kingdom will also join with the United States, Canada, and Mexico. The United States in itself is self-sufficient, not needing to import anything, but from a defense perspective, they will likely want to keep the Atlantic secure with the Brits. France will likely be the dominant force within the Mediterranean, taking into account its existing ties with Northern Africa. Central European countries will face issues and, led by Germany, could potentially partner with France or the UK if it's in their interests, or they could face a struggle and mass migration. Historically, Germany and Russia always had significant ties. The outcome of the Ukraine war will be a likely deciding factor on cooperation with Central European states moving forward. Any transportation of product will need a strong navy to protect the supply lines, as like history shows us, imperialistic regional blocs lead to competition, piracy, and conflict. International cooperation will cease and rest upon financial and economic agreements only. Nations with the strongest naval forces, such as the United States, United Kingdom, Japan, and France, will fare well. Landlocked nations or countries with poor naval forces, back to Russia and China again, will not fare so well. The effects of deglobalization over the next 20 years can be compared only to the Black Plague of the Middle Ages in terms of societal reset and drop in population. In comparison, both previous world wars are but a small fraction of what we are facing in terms of population drop. In simple terms, with no people to make the stuff gets less and shortages of everything will affect everyone. The important stuffs like food and fuel will only contribute towards a further population decline, which forms a vicious circle of events. Whilst all this is bleak, challenging, and a major global upheaval, the significant risk comes from the related conflicts. Because when people and nations get desperate, they go to war, and what makes nations more desperate than their quality of life being taken away, than the basic needs of survival being rationed, or worse still, disappearing. Regional conflicts will almost certainly increase, but the United Nations approach to resolution will slowly go away. Small groups of allied countries will defend each other, but for the most part, the world will regress into regional tensions. But this time, some of the regions will have nuclear weapons. Trade wars, conflict over resources, and wars of production and competition will play out with regularity. Expect national military drafts and compulsory services in countries, a slowdown in technological advancements globally, and widespread shortages of almost every product imaginable, especially food. This knocks onto famine, starvation, and hyperinflation. Propaganda will flood data sets and mass market media, making nationalistic news of today seem like a local news report about a missing cat. With a nosedive in populations globally will come a mass shortage of skills, which will further hamper and ultimately eviscerate industry and production. Migrant crises will spill to every corner of the globe as nations become more protective, more inward-focused, and more protective of their sovereignty. This is not a distant future. This has begun and will concede over the next 25 years, during your lifetime. You will see hardship and regression of your quality of life that you have never seen or experienced before. The only thing that can and will stop this playing out is aggression between nations, which could accelerate the destruction of modern civilization. Chapter 5. Exodus. It's hard to communicate such a bleak message, and trust me when I say my aim is not to scaremonger. The predictive data and evidence to support this global collapse and outcome are watertight. I could lend hope and highlight what nations will fare the best, such as the United States, United Kingdom, France, Canada, Japan, the Scandinavian countries, Mexico, and Australia. But given the risk from the remaining nations, who won't fare as well will pose, the likeliest scenario is mass aggression. A third world war is almost certain, but it will be from desperation and trade and not politics or ideologies. If by some divine intervention the tides of war can be sailed, the alternative would be a much simpler existence, a step back in development. In 1979, Dr. Joseph Tainter, the American, Berkeley and Northwestern educated anthropologist, stated that many scholars had spent years of research on the question of why complex societies have developed, but had devised no corresponding theories to explain the collapse of these systems. Over the next decade, he investigated and developed that theory, which would eventually become the heart of The Collapse of Complex Societies, a book that Tainter published in 1988 and considered the definitive text and authority in the area of societal collapse.
Tainter's argument essentially rested on two proposals. The first is that human societies develop complexity. For example, specialized roles and the institutional structures that coordinate them in order to solve evolving complex problems. For an overwhelming majority of the time since the evolution of Homo sapiens, Tainter contends, we organized ourselves in small and relatively egalitarian kinship-based communities. All history since then and right up to the current day has been characterized by a seemingly inexorable trend towards higher levels of complexity, specialization, and socio-political control. Ergo, larger communities would have to be organized on the basis of more formal structures than kinship alone, of course. A chiefly apparatus, authority, and a nascent bureaucratic hierarchy emerged to allocate resources. States then developed, and with them a ruling class that took up the tasks of governing, or the power to draft for war or work, levy and collect taxes, and decree and enforce laws. Eventually, societies that we would come to recognize as similar to our own would emerge. Large, heterogeneous, internally differentiated class structures control societies in which the resources that sustain life are not equally available to all. Something more than the threat of violence would be necessary to hold them together, a delicate balance of symbolic and material benefits that Tainter calls legitimacy, the maintenance of which would require itself more than ever complex structures and systems which would become ever less flexible and more vulnerable the more they piled up. Dr. Tainter's second proposal is based on an idea which he borrowed from the classical economists of the 18th century. He wrote that social complexity is inevitably subject to diminishing marginal returns. Simplified, it costs more and more while producing smaller and smaller profits. It's a classic Alice in Wonderland situation. You're running faster and faster to stay in the same place. A prime example of this is Rome, which, in Tainter's telling, was able to win significant wealth by sacking its neighbors, but was thereafter required to maintain an ever larger and more expensive military just to keep the imperial machine from stalling, until it couldn't anymore and eventually collapsed. As the benefits of ever-increasing complexity, the loot shipped home by the Roman armies began to dwindle, Tainter writes. Societies became vulnerable to collapse. Stresses that otherwise would be manageable, natural disasters, popular uprising, epidemics, became impossible to overcome. Only complexity, Tainter argues, provides an explanation that applies in every instance of collapse. We go about our lives addressing problems as they arise. Complexity builds and builds, usually incrementally without anyone noticing how brittle it has all become. Then some little push arrives and the society begins to fracture. The result is a rapid, significant loss of an established level of socio-political complexity. Or in human terms, that means central governments disintegrating and empires fracturing into small, petty states, often in conflict with one another. Trade routes seize up and cities are abandoned. Literacy falls off. Technological knowledge is lost and populations decline sharply. The world, Tainter writes, perceptibly shrinks and over the horizon lies the unknown. Life Science reported in July 2021 that a senior team of MIT scientists supported the dataset and evidence to show that by the 2040s, global civilization will take a sharp downturn, along with the global population, food availability, and natural resources. This imminent collapse wouldn't be the end of the human race, but rather a societal turning point that will see the end of civilization as we know it. And it's too late to reverse or change course. This isn't a secret. Your governments have been aware of this since the early 1970s, and a multitude of evidence and data is available for further reading. In aiding our research for this episode, we utilized the science and work of Peter Zeihan, Dr. Joseph Tainter, Jorgen Randers, Gaia Harrington, and Guy Bar-Oz. Until next time.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.